This is Joe Elia. We've just turned the clocks forward here in the U.S., and so summer is looming after a warm winter for Boston. If the past serves as a guide, we'll have a warm summer, warmer than usual. Sleeping will get tougher, ticks will show up on our ankles, water will beckon us. Clinicians will work in comfortably air-conditioned suites, but their patients will often not be as lucky. Renee Salas reminds you all in a recent NEJM perspective that hyperthermia is just around the seasonal corner. Our friends in the southern hemisphere have just had a horrible summer. Australia's was unprecedented, with an average temperature exceeding 30 Celsius or 86 Fahrenheit. We'll talk about such things with Dr. Salas, who is a fellow at the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at the Harvard School of Public Health. She's also in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Salas.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It used to be that summer was a time for bug spray and sunscreen. Everything's changed, hasn't it?
Yes, I think that there has been this growing recognition that climate change is not only happening in the world around us, but it's also impacting us as humans, and it's impacting our health. And it, as this recognition has grown, there has been a goal to increasingly connect it to what we do every day, to our clinical practice.
Yeah, your recent perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine gives a useful table for various healthcare domains, starting with EMTs, who are bringing overheated patients to the ER, all the way out to the management types who need to prepare for what they can't predict yet. Can you talk a bit about that?
So we know that there are associations across a broad range of climate exposure. So that ranges from heat to rising pollen levels, wildfire smoke, infectious diseases, as you noted in the introduction, changes in water quality, and the intensification of extreme weather. But I think that the recognition is that all of these have very practical implications, no matter what your role is in the healthcare system. There was a case that I outlined about a man who was brought in to the hospital because he was confused. But we were in the middle of a record-breaking heat wave, and his wife had called 911, and the EMT said that when they opened the door, that it was like they were being hit by the Sahara Desert heat. And they lived on the top floor of lower income housing, and they had no air conditioner. They only had one window that was partially cracked. And so I think that shows, right, that EMTs are on the front lines. And I think as medicine is increasingly embracing and trying to expand community paramedicine, recognizing that they are, you know, my extensions from the emergency department out in the community. And so how can we use them to educate patients about the risk of heat, counsel patients on what to do if they lose power, even if they normally have air conditioning? The National Climate Assessment put out by the federal government has shown that they anticipate that the intensification of extreme weather and extreme heat are going to amplify and intensify the power outages. We actually had one right down the street, in fact, a power outage at Mount Auburn Hospital. And that actually caused them to have to bring patients down from the top floor of the hospital because it was getting so warm, because the backup generators don't actually supply cooling to all areas. Yeah. And even when the power was restored, a lot of the equipment was so hot that it couldn't function. So they had delayed ability to be able to resume their normal functions because they had to wait for technology to cool down. And this was in Boston, you know, greater Boston, in 2019.
Pretty interesting. And so as we were saying before, there are things that that administrators must prepare for that they can't imagine yet. And I guess the only way to imagine it is to experience it and say, oh, damn, we should have done it this way, this other way. And it's, you know, I mean, we could be jocular about it now, but when it happens, boy, oh boy. For instance, And I guess you can't talk about anything, including candy bars, without mentioning coronavirus these days. What do you think? Do you see any connection at all between, global warming, climate change, and this kind of spread of infection? Is that at all on your radar, or is it a strong signal?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we know that vector-borne diseases, so diseases transmitted by mosquitoes and ticks, that those have been on the rise. So not only longer seasons, but moving to new geographic regions, which makes it hard for clinicians because now suddenly they're facing, patients who come in potentially with infectious diseases that they haven't been used to seeing. And Lyme disease can present in a multitude of ways, and one that has really been expanding here in the Northeast. So, every rash to me in the emergency department has to potentially be Lyme.
Yeah.
But I think that shows that we really need to have a dynamic education curriculum and work closely with our public health colleagues in order to ensure that we can stay up to date on emerging infections and also make sure that we can educate our clinicians on those signs and symptoms of diseases that they aren't used to seeing. There's always this issue, right, that we face these situations in research because of the sound scientific practice it has to go through is delayed. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I feel that climate change is truly that meta problem and that threat multiplier. So I believe it connects to everything in some way, whether directly, indirectly, or even, even if it's minimal effects. So, my concern is that, climate crisis may be fueling coronavirus in some way, but we don't know yet. It's too early.
Yeah.
And I think that it's just shows that there's so much research that needs to be done because we can't prepare for what we don't understand.
Yeah. And so back to those poor administrators who are going to be held to account when things go wrong. Is it really possible, do you think, to have drills about power failure? I've noted before that the Marathon bombings were made a bit less chaotic because Boston hospitals had practiced, and many cities do practice now for mass casualty events. How does an institution practice for a calamity like power failure?
Yeah, so this is interesting, and I think I really want to promote that table was more of a thought exercise where I was hoping to take the reader with me and thinking through different things that we can potentially implement to help prepare us as clinicians for what the climate crisis has brought and will bring. And I think, we always are better served if we are as prepared as we can be for situations. And I think recognizing that power outages create a limited resource environment in a normally well-resourced hospital. Again, cooling not being in every area and maybe perhaps limited imaging, and all of these unintended and unforeseen consequences that, if a hospital is already gone through that and knows exactly what to do when a power outage occurs, then, inevitably, I'd like to believe that we would then be better prepared when we actually face that. But you always have to weigh kind of the, number of drills versus the benefit. And so kind of rely on my disaster preparedness expert colleagues, to end up making that decision. But it's something to think about.
Well, and speaking of that, if that, say, happened at Mount Auburn, and it did, how efficiently are the lessons of that disseminated to the other hospitals in the region? Are you aware of any formal way that a hospital having undergone such a calamity is able to share that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think one that, I know myself and my colleagues and others are thinking about is how can we share these best practices? Because, even when you think about heat, for example, and the fact that, certain areas of the country and, even the world have been facing extreme temperatures that are, again, extreme for areas like here in the Northeast, but have been facing hotter temperatures and know how to operate in that environment, so we can learn from them. But you bring up a good point that when something like this happens, like the power failure at Mount Auburn, you know, that isn't currently disseminated. I mean, in fact, when I talk about it, even to people in Boston, many people didn't know that it happened. Mm-hmm. And leadership, again, you know, may be aware, but again, just creating this sense of dissemination of experiences, I think, is enormously powerful, so we can learn from one another. I think, you know, when I was come back to my emergency medicine roots and think about that, when a patient is crashing in front of us and we save them, that it's not saved by one person. It's a collective team that saves that patient. Everything from environmental services that cleaned the room to the pharmacist, to the nurse, to the doctor, to everyone. And I think I recognize that this climate crisis needs to collectively bring the medical community together, across all sectors and disciplines, to learn from one another. And I think we're stronger together. And that's part of why we're building this climate crisis and clinical practice initiative, where we're actually going to have symposiums similar to the one that we actually held in Boston on February 13th, in different regions around the U.S. at flagship sites. And even internationally, we currently are going to hold one in Australia. And the goal of that is to come up with a group of us that have different geographic experiences, are exposed to different climate change exposure pathways, and to build a initiative where we can get some expert consensus and ways to share best practices.
Here's a question. What do you say to people who are skeptical about the role of climate change in clinical medicine?
It is enormously hard to scroll through your news feed, since most of us nowadays digest our news through a phone or some tablet of sorts, without seeing that there are new things that people are experiencing in the environment around us. And I think, you know, personally, I think the science is very clear that the climate change is happening, that it's human caused, and we have solutions. You know, nothing is harder for me than having a patient in front of me where I don't have a treatment. And thankfully here we have the ultimate treatment and the ultimate prevention, which is a decrease in our production of greenhouse gases. But I think recognizing that if we want to try to minimize the human suffering that is already happening, especially for vulnerable populations, but recognizing that we also have to simultaneously adapt not only our public health infrastructure, but our clinical practice. And while, you know, some of the implications of the climate crisis are clearer than others now, I think there are these insidious changes that we have to recognize. And if we want to put the health of patients first, and in order to deliver the best patient care that we can, we have to add a climate lens to it, because historically we've always been able to look backwards and, you know, try to predict the future based off the past, but that's no longer possible. And the climate crisis is creating this uncharted future. And we have to prepare now and work together to do that.
I want to ask you how you got interested in this whole question of the clinical implications of climate change, global warming.
I learned about climate change and its impact on health about 6.5 years ago. And it was fascinating because I had not heard about it at all during medical school or residency. And for me, it was really an epiphany moment where I recognized that I could not imagine focusing my career on anything else, because I couldn't imagine anything else impacting my ability as a doctor to protect the health of my patients and to do my job than climate change. And so it really started me on a path that has put me on the course that I'm currently on. And for me, you can call it a job hazard of spending all of my time outside of the emergency department, focusing on climate change. But I increasingly began to see that it was harming my patients, again, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in larger ways. But I quickly saw that there was a need to add a climate lens to what I did in my practice. And I think increasingly, as I had more conversations with others, recognized that, you know, we needed to have a larger conversation to really adapt our clinical practice in the era of climate change, which has led to the initiative that I spoke about.
As a result of your efforts, Dr. Salas, what do you hope will happen?
I think first and foremost, we need to recognize that the health sector and the voices of health professionals is the most trusted messenger to connect climate change and health. You know, I think one thing that at least I personally believe is why we haven't had as much action on climate change and engagement up to this point is that it hasn't been personal. You know, we have had visions of icebergs and polar bears, and trust me, I love polar bears, but it's really about, you know, our children. It's about our aging parents who are enormously vulnerable, our less fortunate neighbors. And if that's not enough to motivate you, then it's about yourself, because climate change is harming your health in some way, again, however small, however large. And so the recognition of making these connections and talking about climate change as a public health threat, and I would argue as, you know, something that is changing our clinical practice, is first and foremost what we need to do as a medical community. So the ultimate then goal of that as we engage in this conversation is that we need to talk about the fact that climate action is actually action to improve health. And, you know, I would say that the Paris Agreement is the world's, you know, greatest public health pact. And so recognizing and connecting these things, and that not only are there the short-term benefits of reducing particulate matter from the combustion of fossil fuels, which we know will improve health, but also the driver of climate change, and thus will decrease, again, the human suffering that we will experience both now and in the future, is really important in encouraging our transfer to renewable energy sources. And then I think the second half of that is adapting. So ensuring that we can adapt our public health practice and our clinical practice to continue to provide the best care to our patients and our communities when they need it most.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today, Dr. Salas.
No, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and for highlighting this topic.
That was our 257th episode. The whole collection is searchable and available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations is a production of the NEJM Group, and we come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.